Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Mexico, ground zero in the global swine flu outbreak. The number of deaths reported now jumped to 152 yesterday. Latest reports say the virus, a cocktail of human, pig, and bird flus, has now shown up in seven countries around the world. Mexico, the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Spain, Israel, and New Zealand, and more suspected already. The question is, will it fizzle into coughs and fevers and some sad hundreds dead, or spread into a real killer pandemic? This hour on Point, swine flu on the move and moving fast. You can join the conversation. Are you double washing your hands yet? Have you been traveling, maybe catching or worried that you've caught this new virus? And what questions do you still have after all the reporting, the calls of alarm, and the calls for calm? We're going to check in a moment with the CDC, with an expert on animal-to-human disease with New York and San Antonio. We begin at ground zero, as it's been called, Mexico. Here's just a taste. Reporter Rosa Flores of Houston's XHTVM 40 on assignment in Mexico yesterday.
Mexican plazas, or town squares, are usually packed with people on the weekends. But this past weekend, plazas were empty. The bleachers where spectators watch soccer matches also empty. Soccer stadiums also empty, and streets in Tijuana desolate.
Empty, empty, desolate. Joining me now, live from Mexico City, is Victor Hugo Michel. He is special affairs reporter for Milenio, one of Mexico's biggest national dailies. Victor Hugo Michel, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So, does it look that way to you? Empty, desolate. Everybody is staying home in Mexico City.
Well, at this point, I could say that the only place that's not empty and desolate would be the supermarkets, because a lot of people are buying and stocking up on goods. Something that we hadn't seen in Mexico, never actually. And so I could say that, yes, life in Mexico City is halting to a ground still, and we still have to see what's going to happen in the next few hours.
Now, we understand
that the collective transportation might be shut down.
The government has more or less called for an end to all public activities for 10 days or so, and what their hope is that that's long enough for the flu to come and go among those who have it, the incubation period to be behind them, and they hope that what creates a fire break on the other side, we pray, no flu?
Yes, that's the idea, that basically this would be able to contain the contagion of the virus. Actually, they shut down 35,000 restaurants for the first time in the history of Mexico City. So That's the idea. The idea is to stop the contact between people so there won't be more infection, because the infection rate seems to be accelerating. It's normal in an infection. So the idea of the government is to try to stop it, to try to slow it down somehow.
We're hearing conflicting reports of the number of dead at this point. We heard 20 at the top of the hour, 152. This may change in the course of this very day, depending on when people are hearing us. But what's the latest you know on the number infected and the number dead?
The latest tally is the one that was given by the local health secretary in Mexico City, and he said that three more people have died of influenza in Mexico City. Now, there is a problem. The tally is not easy to compile, because we don't have yet the lab equipment to identify all the people that have died of this virus. So they're going to start all the tests with the bodies that have piled up in the past 3 or 4 days to try to determine if everybody died of this virus in particular, or if they died of collateral diseases. So that is the problem, and that is why the tallies are not exact. At this point, the most accepted one says that there's 152 people that have died of the influenza virus.
Now, the other question is, there's nearly, I'm looking at a Washington Post report here, of almost 2,000 people hospitalized, but nobody seems to know what the total number infected with the flu is in Mexico, and it makes a big difference. If 150 out of 2,000 die, that's pretty deadly. But if it's 150 out of 20,000 or 200,000, it's tragic for their families, but it's not so bad as a public health issue. What about the overall number of those infected?
that is a massive problem, because we do know there is outbreaks in several states in Mexico. In Mexico, there's about 14 states that now have confirmed cases, but we do not know the total number of infected. That is a big problem, because, as you said, if it's 152 out of 2,000, that's a massive amount of mortality of the disease. The problem is we don't have any confirmed reports about how many people are infected on this. But at this point, we do know that there's 14 states, that's half of Mexico, that have reported cases of influenza. So that is a big problem.
A big problem for Mexico and now for the world. We wish you luck there. Victor Hugo Michel with Milenio in Mexico City. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks.
Across the border, there have been several confirmed cases in Texas. Here's what the local news sounded like in San Antonio on KSAT Channel 12 on Sunday as officials tried to confirm the outbreak there.
Drastic measures this evening in the face of a possible swine flu outbreak. The Schertz-Cibolo Universal City Independent School District is shutting down every school in every administration building. Our Jennifer Dodd has been following this story, and she's live in Cibolo. Jen, you've learned that the city is also taking some steps.
Yes, the mayor of Cibolo, Charles, has ordered every public park in the city closed.
Every public park closed? That's in San Antonio, Texas, USA. Don Finley joins us from San Antonio. He's medical reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Don, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here.
What's at this point the number of those understood to be infected in San Antonio?
Well, as of yesterday, there were three confirmed cases, all in Guadalupe County, which is just outside San Antonio, part of the greater metro area, all students at the same high school. But there were also seven highly probable cases, as they were described, and about 20 more awaiting confirmation. That's just here. Dallas, which is about 5 hours north, their local health department said they had confirmation from the CDC on three cases there, and we're hearing reports on likely cases along the border, so it may be all over Texas.
Have you been all over Texas, and that's a big state? Have you been able to track in San Antonio how those first three, maybe now seven more, came in contact with this? Is there a Mexican connection or that you know of or not?
Well, they're interviewing the cases. The first two were 16-year-old boys, students. They had no travel history to Mexico or to California, but it may not be a productive question. We're 2 hours from the border. It's a Hispanic-majority city. People have family on both sides of the border, and people of all income levels cross to work, to shop, to relax, and wealthy Mexicans buy second homes here.
You're all tied in. We just heard Mexico City basically shutting down for 10 days. What about San Antonio? How shut down or not?
Well, so far, most of it is contained in Guadalupe County. We have not had even a probable case in Bexar County, which is where San Antonio is, about 1.6 million people. So no restrictions are taking place here yet, but everybody is alert.
Not any more than that at this point, but it's up to Dallas now, and you say maybe all over Texas. Don Finley with San Antonio Express News. Thank you very much, Don.
You're welcome.
And joining us now from Atlanta, Dr. Joe Brzee, Chief of Epidemiology and Prevention in the Influenza Branch of the CDC. Dr. Brzee, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How would you describe the arc of this outbreak at this point? Are we still in the global acceleration phase, plateau? Any idea? Do we know? Can we know?
I don't think we can know quite yet. I think we're still describing this as in the initiation phase, where you see sporadic cases popping up in different places with local transmission. We have seen some places like Texas with additional cases, New York and California, obviously, with several cases. But I think the rapidity of spread of the virus and how many new cases we'll see today and tomorrow and next week, I don't think we can be quite sure yet.
I mean, already we're comparing back to Fort Dix in, 1976, and you had some military recruits with swine flu, a lot of vaccination, but the thing seemed to just disappear. This seems way beyond that scope of spread. Does it not already, Dr. Brzee?
I think it does. I think anytime you get a novel influenza virus into a community, into a population that hasn't been exposed to it before, you certainly have the potential for human-to-human spread that extends beyond a small community or small borders. And I think what we'd expect to see in the next couple of days or weeks is additional cases, and I think we fully expect to see some severe cases like they have in Mexico City. And so I think over the next days and weeks, we'll see more states reporting reporting cases, CDC confirming those cases, and we won't be surprised at all to start seeing our first severe cases in the U.S. as well.
We've got a lot of questions here, but I mean, just big picture, it's been hard so far to kind of get an angle on how to see this. I mean, President Obama said be concerned, not alarmed. Maybe that's the right ratio. On the other hand, you know, Spanish flu, 50 million dead, and people talking about pandemic, WHO with the phase 4 rating on this thing now. How are you advising the public to look at this? You don't want to be overwrought about it. You know, maybe it'll disappear tomorrow.
I'd say a couple of things. I think you're right. We're in very early days of this epidemic, and we really don't know where it's going right now. I think that said, CDC is concerned about the spread of this new swine influenza A, and we're acting very aggressively. We're reaching out to state health departments. We're sending teams in the field so we can learn more about what's happening in the field, learn more about how the virus acts, who it infects, what the risk factors for severe disease might be. I think the key over the next week or so for us, at least at CDC and other public health authorities, is to really learn about this virus and learn about how it affects humans. And I think that'll give us a much better handle on what we need to do. In the meantime, we're clearly acting aggressively. We're putting out guidance for how communities should respond and how people should respond.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about swine flu on the move and moving pretty fast. Dr. Joe Brzee has joined us from Atlanta. He's chief of epidemiology and prevention in the influenza branch of the CDC. Dr. Brzee, we've got lots of questions, and you are great at responding to them. We've got other responders here as well. Let me go right to Brayton, Iowa, and Kevin. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to point out that if this is a viral infection and they have to operate those confinements with the fans running all the time, they're basically emitting that virus out.
When you say confinements, you're talking about hogs raised in confinement, bacon bins and all that, factory hog farming.
Right, right. I'm wondering just how they're going to be able to keep the animals alive if they shut off them fans, because for the most part they'll die from the fumes of their own manure. I just see it as being a point source to infect everything within that area.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know if that's even considered necessary. We'll go to Dr. Brzee on that. But let me bring one more voice in to respond as well. Joe Brzee, please stand by. We also have with us from Washington Dr. Michael Greger. He's Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States, expert on animal-to-human disease. Dr. Greger, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
You hear the question out of Iowa, where, of course, a lot of hogs are raised in confinement, as our caller says. He's worried about what the fans blowing out or what's happened if you turn them off. Is that relevant here?
Well, we have not yet pinpointed the exact source of this current virus, but swine flu may indeed be a virus of our own kind of making. The only other time we've seen a swine flu virus like the one we now face, a triple hybrid swine flu incorporating both human and avian genes, was on a factory farm in North Carolina in 1998. Where we had 5,000 breeding pigs, you know, crammed together in these, you know, metal crates are so small they couldn't even turn around. When thousands of animals are crowded into these unhygienic football field-sized sheds to lie kind of snout to snout atop their own waste, it can be a breeding ground for disease. And then there's these tunnel ventilation fans that do kind of, you know, blow this, you know, fecal dust out into the environment where we've been able to, you know, sample, you know, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, etc. But in terms of sick swine at this point, we don't have sick pigs. What we have are sick people.
Dr. Brzee, how about it? I mean, it's not as though, you know, reading up for this show, I was kind of surprised to see how much flu does go around in swine populations. It's common. It's just like in human populations. But it's not as though all hog populations have this. This came from somewhere in particular, we presume. To take us into the origin of this to the extent that we understand it now.
It's a great question, and you're right. We don't know exactly where this virus came from. We we assume it had swine origin because the genes in the virus, the DNA in the virus, are most closely related to some known swine viruses, as Dr. Greger said. I think he's also exactly right. This is a virus that's transmitting among humans now. We don't have evidence that this virus is transmitting among pig populations, and the biosecurity among pig farms in the U.S. is quite excellent. And I'm no expert on that, but I don't think there's a huge risk there. I think there is a risk of transmitting this virus back into pigs but humans, and the pig industry is working on preventing that.
Do we know if in Mexico it came from a big factory farm, hog farm, or, you know, small kind of backyard hogs rooting around?
I don't think we know that. In fact, I was asked that yesterday, and I think, in fact, for the human side of the investigation and the response, the question of where the virus first came from is somewhat less important to me now than what to do about the human cases and how to prevent the human cases and spread. I think where CDC is focused now is to understand how much disease is out there, what the disease looks like, and what we can do about it.
It's on the run. Let's go to Karen in Burlington, Vermont. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, my dad lives in Mexico. He lives about 4 hours from Mexico City, and he's planning on traveling back for the summer to Vermont on the 11th. And so,
are you going to be waiting at the airport with a big hug and kiss?
That's what I want to know.
What?
You know, will we know by 2 weeks from now where this thing has come and gone, and will he know if he's had symptoms by then, or, you know, what do we look
when for? When exactly is he expecting to come home, Karen?
Or on the 11th.
The 11th of?
Of May.
Of May. Oh, so just around the corner. Dr. Brzee, okay. What about it? Should Karen suit up, you know, hazmat suit at the airport for Dad?
We'll know more in 2 weeks than we do now. That's clearly true. I would advise your dad that we certainly see transmission of this virus in Mexico as we do in some places in the U.S., and to listen to the public health authorities. And if he gets sick, to talk to his doctor. I think whether you advise him to come home sooner or not, I think a lot of it depends on what's happening in his community.
But what about the incubation period, and how long does it take to know if someone may have picked it up, to show symptoms and then to be free of the virus?
That's a great question, and that's one of the early questions of the investigation. We're acting under the assumption that the incubation period of these viruses are like other swine viruses that we know about, or are like human virus, and that is in the order of 1 to 4 to 5 days. We do have one pair of cases that clearly transmitted each other, and the incubation period was around that time, 2 or 3 days. And so we're assuming that. We don't know how long the virus sheds. And again, if you take a human virus, which is one of our assumptions, we expect that people are contagious or spread the virus until they get well, or about a day after they get well.
Got a question from Kenneth in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Kenneth. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. What do you think?
Well, I just like to make a couple of comments about the deaths in Mexico. I heard yesterday that they weren't, you know, able to explain it. I just think it's because we have a better healthcare system in the United States. And also, we have an illegal immigration problem in this country, and 5,000 to 6,000 averaging crossing the border daily. And due to this, that, you know, those numbers should go up. And I was just wondering, you know, what we think about possibly doing something to secure our borders. And just one final thing about the thermal scanning in other countries that they're doing.
This is China and others that can see if you've got a fever just by looking at you with a thermal scanner, yeah?
Yes, as people are coming off airplanes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious on why
okay.
we're not doing that in this country.
Good. Thanks very much, Kenneth. Joe Brzee, what do you say to those issues?
All great questions. Let me start with the first. The first is it relates to why the Mexican authorities and the Mexican population are seeing more severe cases than we have so far, at least in the United States. And again, I hate to keep highlighting what we need to know, but that certainly we do need to know why that is. I think one of your earlier guests remarked on the fact that we don't really know how much mild disease there is in Mexico. We expect there to be a lot. And so we don't know what the real risk of severe disease is if you get this infection in Mexico. I think regarding the border issues, I think there are a bunch of issues there. we assume, and mathematical models and experiences told us, once an infectious disease, especially a respiratory infectious disease, has crossed the border from one country to the next and is introduced in several places, the value of trying to screen passengers or screen incoming people to try to prevent more spread of the virus is very difficult and likely impossible. I think people come and they're infected without fever frequently, and there's just too many people to check. It's logistically impossible, but in fact we have disease in the United States, and therefore we're not going to set up any entry screening at this point.
I mean, illegal immigrants don't go to entry screening in any case. Is that an issue that breaks out separately from all the traffic that goes by road and air all the time anyway between U.S. and Mexico, or not?
Well, it does, and I would make the point that some of our border stations are actually and have for many years looked for sick travelers coming in and done some interviews and screening and treatment of sick travelers if they need to. So there is some opportunity for that, but I want to make the point that that sort of activity, entry screening for fever or illness, is not going to be an effective way to prevent spread of this into the United States and further spread in the United States.
What do you make of the fact that in Mexico, according to the reporting we're reading, it's relatively young adults, which you would think is the population's most healthy, that had been the first to succumb, even die?
That's right, and I think that raises two possibilities. One is that it's true that the virus preferentially attacks young, healthy people, and the other is that's who's coming to hospital or that's who's being picked up by their surveillance. And I think the Mexican authorities, along with CDC field teams, are down there trying to ferret that out right now. I don't know that it's true right now.
And thermal screening, do we do that at all in this country? I've seen China and others that had the SARS and avian flu epidemics to deal with in Asia are doing it, picking people out of crowds. Do we even do that in the U.S.?
We've experimented with it, and we've done testing on thermal screening, and I can't say that no one does thermal screening in the U.S., but CDC has done and is doing studies to evaluate how effective it is.
Let's go to Peter in Nashua, Iowa. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I'm going to be flying to Israel on Thursday, and that's about a 14-hour flight. And with the space that's super confined, I mean, you get colds, you get anything on a plane with as many people. My question is how easy is it to get the swine flu in such a confined space for a prolonged period of time?
Well, I guess that's another one for you, Dr. Fazee. Dr. Gruger, I know you're there. We've got more questions coming for you. But Joe?
Yeah, you keep asking me difficult questions to answer. I think that the answer is if we're making an assumption that the swine flu spreads much like seasonal influenza, you can get infected by being close to a person and being coughed on or sneezed on. But I would caution the fact that we see some swine flu in the United States, not tons, but we see some, and so there probably is some risk. I can't say that risk is low or high at this point. Now, I think as you get closer to your flight, please pay attention to what the local health authorities are telling you.
You know, I have to say, in all of your responses, I mean, you're very well modulated, and you seem right on the sort of beat of what we know now and aware. I mean, so cognizant of what we don't know now, but it seems like sort of the message behind what you're saying is really anything could still happen here. You guys seem to be wide open to something. I mean, I hope it's good, but you seem to be wide open to something pretty bad.
I think that the fact that we do have lots of unknowns, it's a new virus and we're learning about it every day, and I think that that's why we've taken a fairly aggressive approach in the first week or 10 days of knowing about this epidemic, aggressive in terms of getting guidance out there, aggressive in terms of installing some measures to mitigate community spread and getting vaccines starting to be developed and getting antivirals, the medicines that can treat this infection, out to our state partners very quickly.
Let's get a call from Jennifer. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you know?
I enjoy your show, and I love the one about the PSA count. That was very informative.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I have a question about the bird flu, because I remember the media really covering that with all the scenes on television, morning, noon, and night, CNN with all the Asians wearing their masks,
right.
And now we're seeing it from Mexico. So what did happen to the bird flu? Why, I haven't heard anything about it. Everybody was preparing and bracing themselves for that. And two, the fact that if we had more of a national health care, at least walk-in clinics for people, they could go in, treat their symptoms earlier, and stop the spread. So for Ted Kennedy's act of health care, hopefully that'll get passed someday.
Jennifer, thanks. Let's pick up the bird flu first. Dr. Michael Greger, yes, indeed. All the cameras and broadcasters were on that. It seems like not so long ago. All the masks in Asia. Jennifer wants to know what happened to that. And what about our readiness from your perspective here now with this outbreak, Dr. Greger?
Well, H5N1, the highly pathogenic bird flu virus, emerged in Hong Kong in 1997, and although it has killed a few hundred people, that's been over a decade span. The concern about that particular virus was it seemed to have a very high case fatality ratio. So over half of the people that we found infected with this disease seemed to die from it. So that's why there was particular attention paid to that flu. But that flu wasn't even good at spreading from birds to people. It's been around over 10 years again. Hundreds of millions of birds have died, but again, very few people. The concern about the swine flu virus now is that it seems to be able to pass rather effectively from person to person, and that's why the WHO has bumped up the pandemic stage to 4, because we do seem, at least in certain confined areas, this efficient human-to-human spread, which is why we're particularly concerned. Although what bird flu did do for us was to get us more prepared, to get our national strategic stockpile of these antiviral treatment drugs, and got the government doing these kind of test scenarios so that we're better prepared to deal with any flu viruses, including the new swine flu.
So maybe some benefit in that. We've got a caller here from China, Beijing, China. Lucia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm listening to your show here in China. It's quite late here, but I'm flying to New York tomorrow, so we've been talking a lot about swine flu. And my concern is I think that a lot of cases might not be reported, and I can't imagine that there would be people who might feel sick here and would just think that they would have the normal flu. So I noticed that there hasn't been cases in Southeast Asia so far, except one in New Zealand, but I find it really hard to believe. So I was wondering what your guest thinks about that. I mean, I'm not afraid. You know, I've been taking, good things for my immune system, so I'm not,
yep,
not terribly nervous, but I still think that it must be underreported.
It's a great question, right out of Beijing, China, with Lucia listening there. Lucia, thanks for joining us. Come again. Dr. Brzee, how about global reporting and CDC confidence in it? No reports. I mean, South Korea, a suspected case, nothing out of China yet, but Lucia's sitting in Beijing and wondering if that can really be true, or we just don't know, or it hasn't been reported.
I think it probably could be true, or it will be true soon. I think that countries all around the world are beginning to look for this fairly aggressively, and they've got the tests for it. Most countries do, and certainly China does. And they're starting to test some of their patients they're seeing with respiratory disease. And so, again, I would be surprised if we didn't start seeing more and more countries reporting their first and second and other cases in the next few days, including places like China.
And if it does continue to accelerate in the United States, what broadly is the game plan here? What happens?
I think we do a couple of things. And luckily, as Dr. Greger said, we've spent about 3 or 4 years now working a lot on pandemic preparedness and figuring out exactly what we do and exercising those plans, which are paying big dividends now in this epidemic. I think what we would do on – we have many fronts, and we would change our reporting ways to make them easier for states who are dealing with sick people. We've pushed out, like I just said, a big chunk of our antiviral medications to states. We've stockpiled that over the last couple of years. That's meant to be used for treatment of sick patients in states. We're distributing now 25% of that to all our states. We'll distribute the other 75% as this epidemic and if this epidemic continues. And we'll start recommending more specific community guidance so communities can start to try to limit the spread on their own.
Well, we will be listening very carefully. Dr. Joe Brzee with the CDC joining us from Atlanta. Thank you very much. I know you're busy these days. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Brzee.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, like the whole world, about swine flu on the move and moving pretty fast. We're going to go to New York in just a couple of minutes where they've had cases of their own. We've been joined from Washington by Dr. Michael Greger. He is an expert on animal-to-human disease transmission, director of public health and animal agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. We've got questions from all over here, Dr. Greger. Let's get one from Burlington, Vermont, kind of up your alley. Eric, you're on the air, Eric.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Basically, my question is this just a natural consequence of such a the mass, big business kind of growing of animals, with whether they be pigs or steers or chickens? I mean, having been confined so much, is this just the start of what we're going to see? I mean, we had avian flu, and then now the swine flu, and then in kind of unrelated, but the E. coli outbreaks. Is this just a natural consequence of how we do business?
Thank you, Eric. Dr. Greger, this is sort of in your wheelhouse. These flus move in animal populations. I guess that's always been the case and remains so. But what about the way we deal with farming and raising our food now? I've got a question here also from our website, onpointradio.org, from Todd saying, swine flu, so where are all the sick, dead pigs? Illuminate us, Dr. Greger.
Well, now in the age of global commercial airline travel, viruses can escape our grasp literally in a matter of days, as we've seen. So although certainly understandably the focus is now on pandemic prevention and preparedness and containment, attention does need to be placed on preventing the emergence of these viruses in the first place.
Right.
In the last few decades, dozens of new human diseases have emerged at a rate unheard of in the annals of medicine, and most of them, about 70%, are coming from the animal kingdom. So just taking the broader view for a moment, you know, the leading theory as the emergence of AIDS, for example, was the butchering of chimpanzees in the African bushmeat mm-hmm. trade. Live animal markets in Asia led to the emergence of SARS. The exotic pet trade led to the emergence of monkeypox in Wisconsin. But as the caller mentioned, really the greatest change in our relationship with animals has been the way billions are now raised for food around the world. And these so-called factory farming practices have directly led to the emergence of a number of deadly diseases in people, such as mad cow disease or strep suis in China, Nipah virus in Malaysia, these multi-drug-resistant foodborne bacteria.
Why would factory farming encourage that? Because of the packed numbers of animals, or so faster genetic mutation, or what?
Well, in the case of mad cow disease, for example, it was the feeding of slaughterhouse waste, blood, and manure to farm animals to decrease feed costs. The multi-drug-resistant bacteria emergence was due to the fact that we feed over half of the antibiotics produced in the country to farm animals just to promote growth and prevent disease in such a kind of stressful and unhygienic environment. But in terms of these influenza viruses, swine flu among pigs spreads just like human flu from these, you know, respiratory nasal secretions. And so when you pack them literally kind of snout to snout by thousands in these facilities, there's the overcrowding, there's the stress crippling their immune system, there's the unhygienic environment, and there's the lack of sunlight in these facilities. Sunlight is actually quite effective in destroying the influenza virus, but when you keep all these animals inside, it's kind of the perfect storm environment for the emergence of these so-called super strains of influenza.
I want to ask you a kind of a selfish question here, but we've got, most of the world doesn't live in agricultural settings anymore. I happen to grow up, right in the middle of lots of livestock, working with sheep and cattle and lots of hogs, up to my elbows. Does that mean I might have immunity, or people who are, often in proximity, and that people in urban populations would have less immunity or not?
Well, unfortunately, this is a new virus. This swine flu virus is different than any swine flu virus we've ever seen. In fact, it seems to be kind of a quadruple reassortment virus, combining not only human and avian genes, but swine genes from both North American and European pig populations. And so with a new virus, unfortunately, there may be no pre-existing immunity to such a virus, although there have been H1N1 viruses broadly circulating the human population. There may be some pre-existing immunity. In fact, the current, if anyone got a flu shot this winter, there may be some immunity. But again, this is a new virus, and whenever there's a new virus, that's really one of the kind of three criteria in terms of triggering another pandemic, is a virus to which the current human population on the planet has not been exposed.
Let's get a call from Iowa City, Iowa, and Marie. Hi, Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Marie Vitito. I'm in Iowa City, Iowa. Iowa is a big pork-producing state.
Yeah.
many people work with pork.
Yep.
And if this were going to be an outbreak of what's now classified as swine flu, why wouldn't all the people in Iowa be sick first? And let me say that this virus needs to be renamed because it is a mutation. It's a combination of three swine...
swine, human, and avian. A bird, swine, and human. So, yes, it's not just swine. Marie, we've got it. Dr. Greger, what about this question? If it's swine flu and they've got a lot of pork production in Iowa, why not a big hit there?
Iowa, as in every state in the country, has had, you know, epidemics of this H3N2 swine flu and other swine flus that have been circulating in North American pig populations. But this new flu seems to have risen in kind of the essentially the Iowa of Mexico, the large kind of pork production section there. But again, all swine flu is not the same, as your caller has pointed out. This is a new strain which seemed to have arisen in Mexico, but again, is maybe spreading throughout the human population. But that's one of the problems, at least here in the United States. You know, pigs travel coast to coast. They may be bred in North Carolina, but fattened in the Corn Belt of Iowa, and then slaughtered in California. This long-distance live animal transport may rapidly spread these viruses among the animal population, and then should there be a mutation to a form transmissible from human to human, we could see what we're currently seeing now coming out of Mexico.
You know, pork producers don't like this being called swine flu. Marie points out it's not just swine. Should we change the name? Is it too late for that?
Well, I mean, it does appear genetically to be a swine flu, but all influenza viruses come originally from, actually, from bird populations, from waterfowl. It's existed for millions of years as this harmless intestinal bug of waterfowl. But then when spread into land-based terrestrial birds such as chickens or turkeys, or into land-based mammals such as swine or people, it can mutate to a form that is then spread in a respiratory route and can cause quite serious disease in both people and other mammals. So all influenza viruses come from animals, but only when it's kind of transmitted to into a kind of a new form, spreading person to person, respiratory secretions, are we concerned in the human population.
And as Dr. Joe Brzee with the CDC said earlier, that appears to be where we are now, human-to-human transmission going right along.
It does seem to be we're in the kind of initiation stage of a pandemic, and although we really don't know enough about the biology of these viruses to predict what's going to happen with this particular virus, if one looks in history, the reason we're so concerned is that the worst plague in human history was the 1918 pandemic, in which at the time there was a quarter of the world population, but 50 to 100 million people died around the world. More people died in 25 weeks in 1918 than people have died of AIDS in 25 years.
The so-called Spanish flu. Here we've got a post on the website from Mark saying, please, how long will it take to develop a vaccine?
We expect to have a vaccine within 4 to 6 months of a pandemic strain emerging. And right now we're already working on the vaccine from the current swine flu virus. However, the virus may mutate as it spreads and adapts to human beings, and so it might not be a perfect match. But that's why these containment strategies are not all for nothing, because if we can at least slow this virus down, it'll give us that time to massively ramp up influenza vaccine production. And so 4 to 6 months, we should have a swine flu vaccine. And so the greatest concern then would be for, you know, the global south and the developing world that doesn't have the vaccine production capacity, what will they do in the face of a potential swine flu pandemic?
Mark also asks, is there enough Tamiflu in stockpile for the U.S. population?
Well, we have about 50 million doses, thanks in part to the Bush administration Secretary Leavitt. So we have, you know, enough for perhaps, you know, 1/6 of the population.
Is that enough?
In Western Europe, they're doing a bit better, maybe 40%, 50% in some of the countries. Again, we didn't have this back in 1918 or the prior pandemics in 57, 68. These antiviral treatment drugs may be very effective, but they have to be taken ideally within hours of showing the first symptoms. That's why it's really a matter of efficient distribution rather than the absolute quantity that we have.
We've got people asking in all different kinds of ways here. How do you know? I mean, you can get the sniffles, you can get a headache, you can get achy bones, and you only have 48 hours for this to be effective. How do you know when you should be on the horn to the doctor saying, do I have swine flu? Should I have Tamiflu right now? How do you know?
Well, anyone coming down with a symptoms of a respiratory illness in any of the areas which we now have this in the communities really should go to their doctor. We need to be testing for these cases. And although we can't confirm whether or not it's swine flu immediately, what we can do is confirm whether it's what's called an untypeable form. At least we can tell that it's not the typical varieties that are currently circulating now. And so then we would kind of highly suspect that it would be swine flu. And again, the earlier one can get to one's doctor, the earlier ones can get diagnosed, the better chances we could start them on antiviral medication. Although, as the case are now, they've tended to be pretty mild, at least here in the United States.
Let's check in on another big urban population that has had its swine flu. Here's Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York reassuring New Yorkers that the city is large and the number of outbreaks there is small.
There's an important number here for New Yorkers to keep in mind, and that number is one. We have one reported cluster of swine flu at one school, St. Francis Preparatory School in Fresh Meadows, Queens.
One at one school. That was yesterday. Joining us now from New York City is Delthea Ricks. She covers health matters for Newsday. She's author of 100 Questions and Answers About Influenza. Delthea Ricks, thanks very much for being here. Is it still just one at one place?
Well, thanks very much for having me on today. The situation is very fluid. It's changing by the day.
Mm-hmm.
There are 28 cases that were confirmed. However, there are several that are pending, and that's where the real news is, because as the cases are confirmed, of course, what we know about the outbreak in this part of the world expands. One thing I do know today is an employee, this would be the first adult, at the accounting firm of Ernst & Young, has an unconfirmed case. I'm certain more news will be coming out about that, but...
And that's in where, Times Square, or where are their offices?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's in mm-hmm. Times Square,
mm-hmm.
A very large population center. Penn Station is in the Times Square area, and that's a train station where, you know, just hundreds of trains are coming and going every day with thousands of passengers. I'm sure people have seen it in movies. It's been publicized so well.
Of course. I mean, New York is kind of the world, you know, buzzing and moving and traveling in one city. Is there any possible way to draw a corridor around a city like this, a huge international hub, Delthea?
I sincerely doubt it. And closing the borders would be absolutely impossible. There... As you well know, people come from other states to work in New York City, from Connecticut, from New Jersey. And as I understand it, there may be a cluster of cases in New Jersey. There may be another cluster of cases among elementary school students in Fresh Meadows, Queens. So as we move along day to day, this thing seems to mushroom more and more. But no, to answer your question, it would be virtually impossible to close off, to put a ring around New York City.
Let's get a call from Croswell, Michigan. Don, you're on the air, Don.
Greetings. How are you today?
Pretty well. What do you know, Don?
Anyway, well, back in 1976, we had a problem with swine flu. Now, all the military were required to be vaccinated, and I'm just trying to find out how does that swine flu equate to this current outbreak.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short. Dr. Greger, Fort Dix, New Jersey, 1976. Don was in the military and knows about it. Any relationship here? That one went away. It just kind of went away. Maybe this one will too.
That was just a few cases. In fact, public health authorities around the world really kind of mocked the United States for vaccinating their population. No one else did it. No one else was concerned. And indeed, there really was not a concern about human-to-human transmission. The situation is much different now, where we have cases erupting around the world. And public health communities around the world, the authorities are very clear that this is a potential threat.
One little bit of tape here. Of course, it's interesting that we've had no head of Health and Human Services in the federal government, no Surgeon General, no new head of the CDC under the Obama administration. A lot held up on Capitol Hill. Here's Democratic Senator from Virginia, Mark Warner, at the confirmation hearing this morning for Kathleen Sebelius for Health and Human Services Secretary.
It is essential for the health of the nation that President Obama has in place and the nation has in place a strong Secretary of Health and Human Services to make sure that our federal efforts on this potential pandemic are ably coordinated.
Now, depending when you hear us today, she may have been confirmed by the time you do. But what do you think, Delta? Are we ready as a New York City, big city, or as a country? Are we ready for what's brewing here?
I would like to think that we are. New York City, as most large cities, has a pandemic preparedness plan. That means medical personnel would be allocated to specific hospitals. The federal government would roll out the strategic national stockpile. There would be, as I understand it, there would be an ample supply of antiviral drugs. There would be ventilators available. There was a problem a couple of years ago when a census was taken to see how many ventilators were available.
Because this hits the lungs.
And there was a shortage at that time.
Yep.
But as I understand it now, that's been resolved, at least in New York.
Do you have a personal plan, Delthea? Are you going to stick around?
Yes, I do have a personal plan.
What is it?
And in my book, I outline.
We've got half a minute. Give us the essentials.
The essentials. You should have a supply of water that will last at least 2 weeks. You should have a cell phone and batteries, extra batteries, so that you
why not tap water?
Well, you could have tap water, but if the city's municipal utility people are not at work, your water may not be
okay. Water, batteries. Give us the
batteries,
others, quick.
Blankets, things to take care of a fever, thermometer, just all of those things on hand.
We will learn more on that front. I have no doubt of it, but let's hope that it just turns and goes the other way. Delthea Ricks, author of 100 Questions and Answers about Influenza. Thank you very much for being with us, Delthea.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michael Greger in Washington, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.